This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at numberfire.com, and this is episode 56 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the Number Fire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. We're in this weird spot of the season where we're probably overreacting in some cases, but we're also more than likely properly reacting in other cases. When players have bad fantasy football performances, though, we tend to focus solely on that player. We say, this wide receiver only scored 3 fantasy points, and that's awful. This wide receiver is awful. Take a guy that I was into as a late second rounder this year in Amari Cooper, for instance. Cooper's caught a total of 4 passes for 39 yards over the last 2 weeks. Way to go, JJ. Meanwhile, teammate Michael Crabtree has 87 yards and 3 touchdowns over this time. After week 3, people weren't looking at Michael Crabtree as some sort of bust. How could they? He has a 3-touchdown game under his belt in just 3 games, and he was selected a few rounds after his younger wide-receiving teammate, Amari Cooper. But here's the thing. Crabtree was awful in week 3 as well, just like Amari Cooper was. Had Michael Crabtree not had that blow-up week 2 performance, people would be taking a dump on him today too. Yes, I know he was injured in week 3, and yes, it'd be silly to just take away the top performance in week 2 by a wide receiver. But my greater point here is that it wasn't just Amari Cooper that was bad against Washington last week. It was the entire Oakland Raiders offense. Derek Carr totaled 118 freaking passing yards in that game. Now, this is not to say that I'd be paying the same price that was paid in August for Amari Cooper today. There's no chance that I'd do that, especially with Denver coming up in week 4. But if we take a step back, truly, the only difference between Cooper and Michael Crabtree this year is one performance. One big performance, that's for sure. It was a huge performance. But let's not overstate a 3-game sample size. Let's not overreact when matchups can dictate so much in one game. What really worries me is when a player is lagging behind the rest of his offense consistently. Terrell Pryor is kind of an example of that. Maybe Tyrell Williams to a degree. Brandon Marshall. Eric Ebron, Kyle Rudolph, Isaiah Crowell. I'm not calling each of those players sell candidates, but they're definitely players that you should be keeping an eye on closely moving forward. I get panic-related questions all of the time. When is Amari Cooper going to do what he did in week 1 again, they'll say. I wouldn't bank on it this week, but let's be real for a second. In comparison to his offense, he's really only had 1 bad week, not 2, not 3. That's the context that's vital when thinking about your players on your squad. I just wanted to talk about that for a second before diving into this week's questions, because today is a mailbag show. But before we get to those questions, I wanted to let you know that for a limited time only, you can get $250 for recruiting friends to join FanDuel. That's $250 cash into your account. Just recruit 3 or more friends to join FanDuel between September 25th and October 1st to get your referral bonus after they qualify. Head to FanDuel.com/referralcenter to get started today. That's FanDuel.com/referralcenter. Qualifying referrals only, so see terms and conditions to get full details. All right, let's dig into these questions. This first one is an email from Brian Fox. Could you break down how you treat your bench in season? How many wide receivers or running backs do you have? How being strong or weak at a position changes that? How you view your preemptive pickups like Mike Tolbert for injury upside or Chris Carson, who is maybe going to have a big workload, versus bland depth players at running back and wide receiver? Love your style of analysis and the transparency of your process. Keep up the fantastic work. Thanks, Brian. I appreciate that. This is one of those questions that's important but really hard to give a concrete answer for. Every league is different, but I can at least go over my thought process for the benches that I own. I'll try to cover a lot of different scenarios here. In leagues with a short bench, I'm mostly treating the waiver wire as an extension of my bench. Because there are fewer rostered players, that means there's a larger waiver wire. So I'm actually more inclined to take chances in a 10-team league with 4 or 5 bench spots with my bench than I would in other leagues. That sometimes seems counterintuitive, but you always have to think about what the waiver wire looks like. That is so key with how you manage your bench. In deeper leagues with deeper benches, it's important to always have some stability. This is the opposite of what I just talked about. You want players who can produce because it's difficult to find replacements off the waiver wire when your starters don't. And not only that, but everyone is going to be fighting for one of those 2 players off the waiver wire who are actually producing because there aren't many of them. So it's going to be harder to get those players off the waiver wire. Regarding the mixture of running backs and wide receivers that I have on my team, as you noted, it depends a lot on your roster construction. In leagues where I have solid starting wide receivers, that usually means somewhere else is taking a hit in my lineup because no lineup is perfect. So in those cases, I'll have more running backs or more flyer players that are running backs. The goal here is to try and compensate for your weaknesses. I also am just trying to gobble up as much upside in general as I possibly can. And I'm trying to find players who I may be able to tie together with a starter on my team to improve the starting spot on my roster. The classic 2-for-1 deal. As for handcuffs, you mentioned Mike Tolbert. I'll get to that with the next question. The next one's from Twitter, @StayFunLaco. When do you start thinking about picking up your running back handcuffs? So I talked about this a bit last week, but I think that you can always pick up handcuffs throughout the season. But early on, it's important to do so as long as you're not sacrificing true upside or a very usable asset on your bench. If you have someone like Brandon LaFell sitting on your bench, you can drop him for a handcuff. That handcuff has more upside than Brandon LaFell. We've seen Brandon LaFell's upside in the Cincinnati Bengals offense. Not only does he need an injury to AJ Green to happen, but even when that happens, he's not the most usable wide receiver on the planet. And like I said last week, that handcuff that you do pick up could be a handcuff for a running back that you don't even own to capture maximum upside. If you don't own Le'Veon Bell, you can pick up James Conner. That's okay. And we get a clearer and clearer picture of handcuffs as the season goes on as well. That's a big part of the strategy in not drafting them. We oftentimes are wrong as to who that handcuff's going to be. Look at Kerwin Williams as the perfect example. Or Jonathan Williams, who didn't even make the Bills roster after he was being selected as LeSean McCoy's handcuff in August. And you also have to look at which situations are strong for these handcuffs. James Conner, who I just mentioned, obviously would be a top-tier handcuff. And you want to see if this player is good himself, too. Am I confident that Mike Tolbert can carry the load without LeSean McCoy in the lineup? Not necessarily. He'd get goal line touches, though, so I suppose that he's okay to roster as a handcuff, but I'd rather own a James Conner-type player. So everything really is case by case, but you can always roster one of those players as long as you're not sacrificing anything significant on your bench. This next one is from John. Hey JJ, you have talked about player regressing to the mean for a statistic. With the limited sample size of football, in your opinion, when is it most likely for a player's regression to occur? Can we expect the next season for the player to regress or after a few weeks? Or does it all depend on the statistic that's being analyzed, like passing yards compared to touchdowns? Thanks, John from Detroit. Pinpointing the exact time regression will occur in football is a literal impossible task. But regression analysis is there for us in the simplest terms possible to see which players are overperforming and which players are underperforming, to see which players are getting lucky and which players are getting unlucky. The unfortunate part of football is that there is not a large sample size. It is not a large sample size game. In baseball, you can actually do really strong analysis to see when certain statistics start to stabilize or become essentially what they appear to be. But it's only possible because there are 162 games in a season and multiple at-bats in a game, giving us a larger sample size even in just one season. In football, any stabilization takes multiple years for us to feel confident about a certain situation. There was one study I found on a site called Intentional Rounding, for instance, that showed that it took 667 carries with the same team to get a true gauge of a running back's touchdown scoring ability. And when it came to yards per carry, it's basically impossible to know when things are actually stabilized. That's not that much of a shock. So when someone like Chris Thompson is doing what he's doing right now, scoring a touchdown on every 7 touches, that realistically could keep up over the course of the season. But if you play probability, it more than likely will not. But it's impossible to say this is when it won't keep up. And it's not just because of straight up regression. It's because someone like Chris Thompson's usage could change. He could get injured and so on. The approach I take with regression is that the instant you see something unsustainable, but a league mate doesn't, and that league mate wants to buy a player at that unsustainable rate, you sell him. That's part of what I talk about each week in my 15 transactions column, honestly. I hope that answer helps, even though it once again didn't give you anything concrete. This next one's an email from Brad. He says, JJ, I've been listening for a long time to Living the Stream, and now I'm also really enjoying your work on the Late Round Pod. Thanks, Brad. I read various start-sit pieces throughout the week, and it seems inevitable that I've got a great candidate to start based on matchup and opportunity. But I'm staring at a solid but not a stud player like, say, Keenan Allen, that's projected to have a higher total but isn't really discussed in any detail in many start-sit pieces. So I'm curious. How often do you find your start-sit plays varying from the projections on whatever site you happen to be using? And what should I be looking for when I'm faced with these types of decisions? Thanks so much and keep up the awesome work. Brad. I wanted to talk about this question because it's more about content consumption than anything else. And I can speak to my Start Sit column and podcast specifically. Most Start Sit columns aren't going to say, hey, play Keenan Allen this week, because the assumption is that you are playing Keenan Allen this week. Keenan Allen in a moderately tough matchup is still better than Jermaine Kearse in a great matchup. There's this notion of start your studs in fantasy football, which means that you should play your studs no matter what. I don't always agree with that idea, but the assumption being made in a start sit column is that you are indeed starting your studs, or even your second tier studs, like a Keenan Allen. Now, you should be worried about those players when they're specifically called out as a sit in one of those columns, because then you know that the matchup is truly that bad. Like Amari Cooper this week against Denver. That's when a lower tiered option may honestly be the better choice above someone like Amari Cooper. Of course, thanks to variance, Amari Cooper is probably going to go off this week. But that's generally why you're seeing the things that you are in those start sit columns. Stating the obvious would make for really annoying and obnoxious content. Talking about the fringe players or looking at sleepers is what it's all about. This next one is from Twitter, at ConVTun. With McCaffrey not living up to his ADP, is he a sell or wait and see? And what range of players should I aim for in a trade? You could argue that this is a sell low moment if you're willing to separate yourself from Christian McCaffrey, but the selling low is only because he's not finding the end zone. And that was something that was scary with CMC entering the year. Cam Newton and Jonathan Stewart are both able players at the goal line, and the Panthers are using Stewart at the goal line. Jonathan Stewart has 4 goal line carries, and Christian McCaffrey has yet to see one. And I don't think selling McCaffrey right now makes that much sense either, because he's actually a good play this week against New England. The team should see a negative game script, which means more usage for McCaffrey, similar to what we saw in Week 3. But I also want to remind you guys of something that I talked about on this show last week. Stop thinking about the type of players that you want to receive in a trade for someone and start targeting owners who may view someone like Christian McCaffrey as more usable than you do. Find value through ownership perception. It's just like a sales deal. You're finding someone who values the thing that you're giving them more than you do. I think I'd hold Christian McCaffrey for now, though, especially in a PPR format. This next one's from Twitter, at Brandon J. Hook. Would you rather own Wentz, Tyrod Taylor, or live the stream the rest of the season in a 12-teamer, 6-point touchdown league? The answer to this one is easy. You're living the stream. There are very, very few quarterbacks in most one-quarterback league formats that are worthwhile every week starters. It's just how the position is when there are so many readily available. And another reminder for you guys, the difference in a 6-point per touchdown pass versus a 4-point per touchdown pass league isn't really realized on a week-to-week basis. It really doesn't change the way that you should value quarterbacks. I did a study on this a couple of years ago on NumberFire if you'd like to read it, but it's important to not overinflate the value of a quarterback in those types of leagues when the demand for the position remains the same. If you're starting one passer, you can, generally speaking, devalue the position. This next one's an email. It says, JJ, love the show and really enjoy living the stream as well. I keep hearing differing points on some of the pods that I listened to regarding this, so I thought that I'd run it by you. The basic question is this. Is there any data to back up the industry's use of Vegas numbers to justify a week's player start or sit? For example, last week, your argument for starting Mike Gillisley was the Patriots were favored by nearly 2 touchdowns, so the game script was likely to be favorable for him. Not trying to pick on you, just the particular situation which brought this to my mind. I do think there must be some data behind this because so many DFS experts cite the totals and spreads constantly when discussing plays for the week. Just curious if you or any of your colleagues had ever really looked into how often the Vegas totals and spreads are actually correct when it comes to game script. Thanks, Zach. Let's address the Mike Gillisley thing here first. You're completely right. I was into him as a start last week and season long and cited Vegas as a reason for that. But I think we have to take a step back and look at what Vegas actually told us. They told us that the Patriots were big favorites to win that game. But without Vegas's help, the same would have been concluded. Citing Vegas is just a way to have some sort of evidence to prove a theory. And you shouldn't automatically always agree with Vegas either. Those numbers are influenced by a lot of different factors because they want the public to lose. They just generally give us more evidence as to what could happen in a particular game. And sometimes a particular game doesn't go as planned. Crap happens. It's a game of variance, and we have to embrace that. But to your question about studies on Vegas and its impact on fantasy football, yes, there are hundreds of articles that talk about this. I'd just do a quick Google search of Vegas lines in fantasy football, and you should be able to find that there are a ton of articles on this topic. I will say, though, that some people do overuse Vegas. I think that's certainly a thing. To me, Vegas is just a piece to the larger puzzle, not the entire puzzle. This next one's from Twitter, at Dave Holtz. I have Zeke, Hunt, Montgomery, Bell, Carson, Gore, Kamara, and Burkhead. Want to trade some running back depth for a wide receiver. Who do I trade? Since running back is scarce in cases like this, I try the classic two-for-one deals. I'd pair someone like Gore and Kamara for a decent enough flex wideout or a high-end bench receiver. If you're looking for a starter, then I'm fine with dealing any running back as long as you're getting something similar in return. I'm a fan of pretty much all of the high-end guys that you have on your squad though, Dave, and pairing them with someone like Frank Gore may enable you to get an elite wideout. So it depends on the type of receiver that you want. If you're looking for depth, trade two of the lower-tiered running backs like Gore and Alvin Kamara. I doubt Burkhead has that much trade value. And if you're looking for a usable starter, I would pair Gore with probably someone like Zeke to get a sweet upgrade at wide receiver. That's generally how I would approach it. This next one is from Twitter, @DominateFF. Sup, JJ? Someone spent all their fob to get Jordan Reed. At what point do we decline the value of injury-prone players? His upside just isn't worth 100% of my free agent auction budget when that potential upside will likely appear in just a few games of the season. So two factors come into play here, in my opinion. The position the player plays and the player himself. Injury proneness is a super subjective thing to begin with, so I'm not sure how we can consistently tag that across all players. Keenan Allen's been, knock on wood, healthy this year, but he's been tagged as injury prone. Matthew Stafford was once an injury prone quarterback. It's something that changes all of the time. Tight end is just a position that sustains a lot more injuries than other positions in fantasy football. And moreover, it's a position that's not all that important in fantasy football since the supply outweighs the demand. Well, sort of. There's like two usable tight ends in fantasy football right now, just to be clear. But every team that doesn't have Gronk is basically suffering at the position, so it's not that big of a deal if you don't have one that's dominating. So in the case of Reed, I probably wouldn't have gone ham with my fob for him. Mostly because he's playing a position that isn't that important in fantasy football. That, and he came into the season with an injury. It's not like his, quote, injury proneness is going to hit him out of nowhere. It's already hit. He's already injured. Overall, though, it's a case-by-case and position-by-position thing. This last one is from @MonoxFF. Is Chris Carson a sell high? I'm going to go back to what I talked about earlier, and that's that the only players, in my opinion, who are true sell highs are players who are performing at an unsustainable rate, or they're doing things at an unsustainable rate. That unsustainability may be in the form of regression, or it may be in the form of another player eventually stepping in and taking away volume. Jaquizz Rodgers is a good example of that. So is Chris Carson a sell high? Well, he's playing starter snaps for the Seahawks, he's been the best Seahawks running back, and he's not performing at a rate where you're sitting there saying, no way he keeps this up, unless you really think Chris Carson is terrible. This is not a Chris Thompson type situation. To me, Chris Carson's downside is in the form of coaching decisions or putting in other running backs because he's inexperienced, and that he may wear down. He really didn't carry the ball that much in college, which is the main reason that I didn't like him as a prospect. But I sure as hell liked him when the preseason hit. So should you sell high? I'll say this, you should always be willing to hear trade offers for a player. Sometimes you're going to be disappointed with those offers, but sometimes you're going to find someone who values Chris Carson as an RB1 from here on out, and then you get a steal. Be open to any sort of transaction in fantasy football. That's it for the questions though this week. Thanks everyone for tuning in. If you've yet to subscribe to the show, please do so by going to iTunes, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. And remember, if you leave a rating and review on iTunes, you'll automatically be entered for a chance to win a NumberFire premium subscription for an entire year. I'll be drawing a name at random off of iTunes next week, so do that as soon as you can. You can also follow me on Twitter, @LateRoundQB, and if you have any questions for next week's mailbag show, you can send them to Twitter or email me at jj@numberfire.com. Thanks, guys. Enjoy your weekends, and enjoy week 4.